Welcome to Hometown Heroes, and I'm actually back home in the Valley this week. The last couple of weeks, we've been on the road. You heard from Pearl Harbor Survivors when the baseball team took me to Honolulu. And then last week in Washington, D.C., we visited with a few veterans at the World War II Memorial there in Washington, D.C. If you were alive during World War II, if you're a student of World War II history, I'm sure you have already realized the significance of today's date. June 6th, 2009, subtract 65 years, and you end up with June 6th, 1944. D-Day, we mark that anniversary today. There will be remembrances all over the country today. And I thought before we get to our guest today that it would be appropriate to hear some famous words that were uttered alongside that fateful day by the man who was in charge of Operation Overlord. That, of course, would be our former president, then General Dwight Eisenhower. Here's what he said to the troops that day.
Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you. In company with our brave allies and brothers in arms on other fronts, you will bring about the destruction of the German war machine, the elimination of Nazi tyranny over the oppressed peoples of Europe, and security for ourselves in a free world. Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened. He will fight savagely. But this is the year 1944. Much has happened since the Nazi triumphs of 1940-41. The United Nations have inflicted upon the Germans great defeats in open battle, man to man. Our air offensive has seriously reduced their strength in the air and their capacity to wage war on the ground. Our home fronts have given us an overwhelming superiority in weapons and munitions of war and placed at our disposal great reserves of trained fighting men. The tide has turned. The free men of the world are marching together to victory. I have full confidence in your courage, devotion to duty, and skill in battle. We will accept nothing less than full victory. Good luck, and let us all beseech the blessing of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking.
Boy, amen to that. That was 65 years ago, Dwight Eisenhower exhorting the troops, and of course we know the end of that story. That was the beginning of the end, I suppose, for Nazi Germany. And the beginning of that huge surge through Europe that the Allied forces came out victorious from. Many of you had friends or family that perished on June 6, 1944, in the campaign that followed. And a part of the purpose of this program is to honor those sacrifices, honor those who paid the ultimate price for our freedom, and also to keep the stories alive of those who lived to tell of their experiences during World War II. One World War II veteran is with us today. He'll be 87 in November, but you won't be able to tell by his great radio voice. Bob Angelich joins me today. Bob, how you doing?
Fine, thanks.
See, there's that voice. The first time I talked to you on the phone, I said, this guy has to be on the show with a voice like that. You make me envious here. And I understand that people often say to you, with a voice like that, you ought to be in radio. And what do you respond with?
I informed them at one given time I was for 3 years. With the United States Air Corps.
Uh-huh. A very important purpose behind your radio work back then. Let's start a little earlier than that, and we might get to a couple of your cousins on this program in the next few weeks if they're up for it, too, a family with a lot of good stories of service to share. How did it start for you? First off, maybe you can tell us what you remember about that day that if you listen to the program, you hear me ask a lot of veterans about. December 7th, 1941. Do you remember where you were and how you heard about the attacks on Pearl Harbor?
Absolutely. Our mother used to love to take a Sunday afternoon drive. So that particular day, we were originally from L.A., and we were on the Pacific Coast Highway and listened to a music program, and suddenly they break the program to inform us that Pearl Harbor was bombed. And I looked at Mom, she looked at me. What are they saying? You know, we just couldn't believe it. Mm-hmm. And then sure enough, periodically, they gave news. And the tragic note within our own family, we lost a first cousin. Jerry was on Schofield Barracks. Mm. And when the attack occurred, he was a gunner on one of the bombers, and he ran to one of the gun emplacements, and he was cut down, as they say.
Wow.
So that was our introduction to Pearl Harbor.
Wow, and I guess if you were short on any motivation to join up, that gave you all the motivation you needed.
At that given time, I felt that there was a tremendous amount of patriotism. And I know I was going to Compton Junior College at that time, and Monday, half the class wasn't there because they had gone down to enlist.
Mm-hmm.
I was the other half still attending school.
Mm-hmm. But it didn't take long, probably.
No, it didn't. I volunteered. It was in January of 43 for the Air Corps.
Mm-hmm.
I always envisioned myself as being a fighter pilot. Is something that I, as a kid, just dreamed about.
Never heard that one before.
It
amazes me how many people joined because they wanted to fly, and some of them ended up flying, but many others, there was a different plan for them.
My big problem was one eye was 20/20, and the other was 20/25. And the thing that I really appreciated, they gave me what they called a refraction test at that time to make sure that was my eyesight. And I implored upon the colonel at the finish of the examination, look, it's so close to 20/20. He said, look, son, we can build a lot more planes than we can train pilots. So with that, I stayed in the Air Corps, and I asked to go to the photographic school because it was flying. And there was a six-month wait. And then the second choice was radio. I envisioned myself as being a radio gunner. Youth needs mental help.
Glutton for punishment, huh?
True. It was only afterwards, Paul, that we realized what they went through, and it was horrific. So
you were hoping maybe have a seat on the side of a bomber, manning a radio station, and having your little window to shoot at the Japanese or the Germans through? Mm-hmm.
Paul, I never felt that I would never come back. I always felt that nothing could happen to me, as though I was invincible. And I never felt that the enemy was going to be an enemy. I felt that I was an enemy to them. And I just envisioned myself as being, shall we say, kind of a gung-ho individual and a marksman. And anything came towards our ship that I would knock it out of the sky. Positive thinking.
I guess so.
Yeah.
Did you ever come to a day where you said, I don't know, this military thing, I'm not sure if this is for me. I don't know why I did. I don't know why I signed up when I did. And, boy, I really wish I could go home right about now.
I think about the second day in the service.
An honest man.
Paul, there was a little joke. Somebody said, well, when did you go in the service? And I said, well, after I went in, I was in the infirmary for 2 weeks. How come? I said, it took them that long to take all the slivers out from underneath my nails when they dragged me off the porch.
I haven't heard that one before. That's pretty good. So you ended up finding a job with the U.S. Army Air Corps, the predecessor to what we know now as the Air Force. And did you ever get to fly a little bit?
We, first of all, I was assigned to Antigua, British West Indies is an island down there. And after I was assigned from Puerto Rico, where it was the transit area, we flew down to Antigua. Then when I was sent over to India, we flew from Antigua to Florida, Barbados, Ascension Island, then over to Casablanca, and then right down through the Middle East and into India, and then in India. And then I volunteered one time to take a flight over the Himalayas, which wasn't a smart thing to do.
Well, but you broke a couple rules there. One, you're never supposed to volunteer for anything in the Army, right?
True.
And when you have to fly over the hump, you better know what you're doing. This is not child's play. Did you think it was just going to be a big game and something fun to do? I guess if you've visited all those tropical locales already, it's just another thing to check off your world map. Huh?
Paul, my uncle told me, he said, let me give you a little advice. He said, never volunteer. If they want you, they know where you are. And I was in charge of a shift in the radio room. There were, I think, 15 positions, and they put me in charge of one of the shifts. And they asked for volunteers to show us what a radio man goes through on a flight over into China. And I didn't think at that time that I wanted anyone to feel that I didn't have the bravo to take that flight. Mm-hmm. I think out of maybe 60, 70 individuals, there was only about four of us that took the flight, because there were four air bases within that perimeter. And I think it was January of 45, we lost, it was 25 aircraft out of those four fields because of the monsoon. And then you'd see where they'd disappear from mechanical problems, the weather problems, the monsoons. But I'm glad I took it, because I went over to Kunming and I saw that particular base, what they went through. Also saw the Chinese laborers. It was a fantastic sight to behold.
Well, I want to ask you more about that, but we need to catch our first commercial break here. Sure. When we come back, we'll hear about flying the hump with Bob Angelich and some of the other incredible things that he witnessed during his time in the service during World War II, and also some of what he saw just after the war. I think you'll find this really interesting, and it really paints a picture of just what some of the people who served our country during that time period had to go through. Hometown Heroes today on News Talk 580 KMJ. Taking a sentimental journey with you today on this Saturday afternoon. I'm Paul Leffler, host of Hometown Heroes, which you'll hear each week here on News Talk 580 KMJ. Normally, when you hear me play a song from 65 years ago or so, I'm playing it at the request of a veteran who wants to hear it again. This week, I must have a mischievous streak or something, because wait till you hear Bob Angelich's reaction to that song. I understand, Bob, that was a song that you kind of got sick of during World War II?
Very much so. At the end of the war, while we were all waiting to go home, they kept playing that song. It was almost 24/7. And I think if we could have found the individual in that record, I don't think it would have ever played again.
So it wasn't a very sentimental song for you.
Well, we couldn't realize what they meant by being a sentimental trip. And that was our attitude.
Well, sorry for putting you through the agony
of
hearing it one more time. Now, we talked a little bit before the commercial about some of the things that you were doing during World War II. You ended up with the U.S. Army Air Corps. And when you talk about working in radio and your day-to-day job, you weren't a DJ. You weren't sitting there spinning records for people listening out there. This was important communication work. What kinds of things did you do on a daily basis, and was it something that was the same every day or different every day?
Well, the fact that we had 15 position radio positions there, we naturally were in communication with different bases, and being headquarters there in Chabwa, every ship that would leave India to go over into China, we would transmit the departure of the ship, and then they would have to verify that it arrived, and if not, then there was search and rescue. And at some given times, I was on that particular shift. Sometimes I was on a station where we kept in contact with the other three bases. And other times it'd be like further down India, like Karachi or one of the other bases. And usually when they would contact us, it was trying to find whatever happened to a particular ship, if it landed or disappeared, whatever it might be.
Now, is this something where you were able to speak in plain English the whole time? Were you using some kind of code? Did that change depending on the sensitivity of whatever it was you were discussing?
No, there wasn't any secrecy at that time, Paul. It was really informational, if I could put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
What ship is leaving for where, and has it arrived, and when is it departing to come back to a particular base? Some of the ships that flew over the hump were four-engine C-87s, which is a converted B-24, and some of them would carry roughly about 3,100 gallon drums of gas to supply the interior of China. And the base I was at, we flew twin engines, C-46s. And the tragic note were the ones flying the gasoline, those C-87s, because the drums might leak and there were fumes. And if the air wasn't cleared out of the cabin and the radio man hits a switch, sometimes that ship would just blow up in the air.
And you obviously catch wind of this back at your base.
Well, the first base I was stationed at, Tezpur, we flew C-87s out of there. And I saw a situation where it crashed on takeoff, and it was like a city block of fire. Hmm. And periodically you'd hear one of the drums that go, boom. And my first thought were the four individuals that perished there.
Now, I've talked to a lot of veterans about this, and I've talked to some veterans who've been the victims of friendly fire or catastrophic events like that that are just chance. Is it tougher to swallow as someone who's in the service, who knows that that inherent risk is always there? Is it tougher to swallow when someone dies in a situation like that as opposed to being gunned down by the enemy?
I saw a C-46 upon takeoff, it lost an engine, and it went over on the left side, and then I saw what they brought back. It was part of the wing measurement. It was like a tabletop. And the first thing, at least speaking for myself, that goes into your mind, three lives were lost. And in fact, one individual who was flying for ATC, Air Transport Command, I became acquainted with him, and he came in one day. He says, "Hey, Bob," he says, "I was transferred into flying over the hump." He said, "I'll get to go home sooner." Five flights later, his ship went down. Mm. And the thought that ran to my mind, is this the way you're going home sooner? You know, so it's human life that comes into mind.
And did you have, you told me before that you felt you were invincible. And obviously, you didn't spend a huge amount of time in the air where maybe it would have felt a little more life-threatening or in the trenches. But did you ever have a feeling like your life was in danger or this isn't what I signed up for? This is a little too close for comfort? Or were you able to dodge those situations?
Oddly enough, Paul, I've always felt that the Air Corps would get me there.
Mm-hmm.
And my only concern was going home. There was such a rush. Everybody wanted to get home. And roughly about 2 weeks before leaving Chabwa to go down to Karachi, a C-54, and I knew one of the individuals, disappeared. And I ended up in Karachi, and then one of the fellows that was part of our group, I asked him, I said, did they ever find out what happened? He says, yes, they went to take a shortcut, and they hit a mountain.
Mm.
And that in itself, our flight down to Karachi, one individual was so nervous he lights a cigarette. And in the nervousness, the cigarette drops on the floor, and of all things, Paul, it falls into the cargo bay.
Mm.
Now, that's a 9-hour flight with a cigarette that's lit with barracks bags underneath that floor. That kind of made me a little nervous.
Yeah, that sounds like a ticking time bomb or a fuse, but you're here talking to me, so we know that that worked out okay. And I realize we're bouncing around chronologically a little bit here. I do want to get to you about flying over the hump, but before we talk more about that, I mentioned earlier this is obviously the 65th anniversary of D-Day, June 6, 1944, and you have an interesting story about that time that I think kind of illustrates a point that a lot of servicemen found themselves in as far as not necessarily being in control of their destiny and realizing that Uncle Sam could do with them whatever they wanted and they might not have a clue as to what it was. I think you can really give us some perspective on how much in the dark you and a lot of other people were with what was happening to you right around D-Day. You were nowhere near the European continent. You told us before you were in Antigua, but describe for our listeners, if you can, the events of that time period and what it was like for you to try to figure out, what are they doing with me?
At that time, I was on duty, and this individual comes out of cryptography. He says, "Hey, Ange, they're shipping you out." Now, this is January 6th. I said, "What do you mean they're shipping me out?" He said, "You're on red-hot orders."
You mean June 6th?
June 6th. I'm sorry, June 6th.
Uh-huh.
He said, "You're on red-hot orders." And he said, you and Berrigan and Rocha and Spitzer, they want you back in Morrison Field ASAP. And I couldn't figure out why. And then we had the hopes, oh boy, here's D-Day. We're going to end up in Europe.
And so, you wanted to go to Europe.
Definitely.
You wanted to fight some Axis powers there.
That was a good part of it. The other part, Paul, is the fact that I thought after the war I have a chance to go to Yugoslavia and maybe see some of the family, try to find them. That was one of the hopes
of it. Your Serbian heritage was playing a role there.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And they said that they wanted us back in Morrison Field within 24 hours, either by Army, Navy, or Pan American. Well, we ended up on Pan American on a DC-3, which was kind of a exciting flight. And we landed at Morrison Field. Nobody knew why we were there. So we said, well, that's the Army for you. Well, they got a hold of us the next morning, and they whisked us off over to one of the hotels there at Miami Beach. And first of all, they check our medical records, and any shots that were due, I ended up with 3. And they check your teeth and this is that. Next thing, we're marched up into a top floor that was like a storage room. And they had a wire gate, and the gate is locked, and we're in there. We're one. You know, what the mm-mm-mm is going on, see?
And then, I'm sure there's a million possibilities that go through your mind. Do they think we're spies? What have we done wrong? And is that the kind of feeling you're describing here?
Absolutely. We couldn't imagine, Paul, why. And then here comes a little chaplain. He walks up to us with kind of a serious face. He says, son, would you like me to write home to your family?
That doesn't help.
Why, you know? And next morning, we are escorted into the dining for breakfast. Then we're escorted by the MPs into a small bus. And then we are taken over to Morrison Field. And there's a C-54. We get aboard, and I think there are only 9 of us at that given time, with orders not to be opened until we're in flight. And we can't imagine why. You know, what are they doing to us, see? Well, we get aboard, and the first thing naturally we want to do is rip open that envelope, find out what are they doing with us. And we see you are now being signed, and we interpret this as Chabua. Where is Chabua? And finally, the pilot comes down. He says, excuse us, where is Chabua? Oh, he says, you're going to Chabua. Where's Chabua? He says, in the Assam Valley. There went Europe, there went the high hopes, there went adventure. So we end up in the Assam Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, Paul, right below the Himalayas. And that was a sight to behold. I think they call it Three Sisters, part of the Himalayas.
Mm-hmm.
And it was adventurous.
Well, that sounds adventurous enough to me. And flying the hump sounds even more adventurous, and I still haven't talked to you in detail about that. So we'll do that when we come back. More with Bob Angelich, this week's guest on Hometown Heroes. This is News Talk 580 KMJ. The Wild Blue Yonder, any Air Force veteran, or in the case of Bob Angelich, a U.S. Army Air Corps veteran of World War II, can identify with that music, performed there by our good friends at the Sounds of Freedom Band. We've been talking to Bob, and I keep telling you, we're going to ask him about flying the hump, which he volunteered to do, and we'll get to that now. And when we say the hump, we mean the Himalayas, and so many veterans went through this in what's been called by many the Forgotten Theater of World War II. Veterans of the China-Burma-India Theater, CBI, have been called forgotten heroes, and it does get overshadowed quite a bit by the Pacific Theater, the European Theater of World War II, but there was plenty of valor in CBI also, and really just the sheer, well, I guess the tough nature of going over the Himalayas in not enemy presence necessarily, but Mother Nature posed quite a problem for a lot of pilots and a lot of crews trying to navigate that part of the world. And you not only got to realize that when you saw how many didn't come back, but you volunteered to go over it yourself. What was that experience like when you're getting that high and so close to these jagged peaks?
Paul, it was, once again, as you mentioned, a volunteer situation. They wanted us to see what the crew, especially radio man, had to go through during those flights. And I forgot approximately what time in the morning I had to be down at the field, and here was a C-46 loaded with cargo, and we were going to Kunming. And we had checkpoint one was mission hour, where you'd call in given our position. And you're looking down there at the jungle, and you can't see anything but vegetation. And the big problem at that given time, the ships that were lost, part of it was due to weather, the monsoon season, because they flew 24/7, regardless of what the weather was, et cetera, and off they go because the need of supplies. And secondly, mechanical failures. It was not a common situation, wasn't uncommon on takeoff to lose an engine, and you really, I would say the highest percent of the time, lost the entire ship. And flying from Chabwa, going over Burma, it was interesting to look down and see the different, if you might say, points of interest. And then coming into view of Kunming Airport, it was like a plateau, and there was a lake on top that is always, well, to this day, I can still see that lake. And when we landed, the runways were being maintained by Chinese coolies, and they were all dressed into like the pajamas, the blue pajamas. And suddenly I look, and here are some of them with babies on their backs. The women worked right alongside the men. They were crushing rock. They were rolling the rock down, et cetera, et cetera. And then we go into the mess hall, and what we enjoyed was the fact they had fresh eggs, which we never had down in India. So we kind of loaded up on fresh eggs and toast and coffee.
So flying the hump was worth it then, just for the fresh eggs?
Yeah, I would say so. But I wouldn't want fresh eggs every day. I would not care to fly that. And one altitude we flew at was 16,005. And the crew, who predominantly flew at 9,000, would have to put on their oxygen masks. And I wanted to see how high I could go without using the oxygen.
What's wrong with you? What were you thinking?
I wasn't thinking. Anyhow, I wanted to see, and Paul, it was amazing, 16.5. It was like there was a slight restriction, and I didn't feel, at least I didn't think, that I felt woozy. And that was something else that stuck in my mind. And naturally, the radio man, he says, hey, Ange, you call in our particular position. So in the excitement, instead of, I remember the ship's number, it was 1045. So instead of saying Victor George, which is our station, this is 1045, I said, 1045, this is Victor George, you know, out of excitement. And they razzed me to no end when I got back. But when we came back, Lieutenant Winder, who was the pilot.
Well, did you eventually put the oxygen on?
No.
You never put the oxygen
on? Never put it on.
So you flew over the hump without oxygen?
Yeah.
Now there's a claim to fame for you.
They never gave you a medal for it.
They should have given you a dunce cap for it, is what they should have given you.
They should have put me in the brig.
And no one tried to talk you into it?
No. It was like, well, if you're foolish enough, go ahead. If you pass out, well, we'll be at a lower altitude. Maybe you'll come out of it, you know, whatever.
That was one of the things I was most curious to hear from you about, is what kind of effects did that have on your body? Because this is flying at an altitude and in atmospheric conditions that the body just isn't used to.
Yeah. Again, the curiosity, Paul, to see what it was like, you know, without an oxygen mask. And strange thing about it, we all had parachutes in case we had to bail out. Where are the parachutes? Way back in the cabin, where you never have a chance to really speak of to get those parachutes. But one altitude we flew at, it was 10,000, I think that was coming back. And we get into the airfield, and they were like broken clouds. And Lieutenant Winder says, let me see if I can stall this thing. So he puts a nose down, gives it full throttle, and he pulls back on the wheel. And all it did was mush. So he said, well, let's see if we can do it. I said, excuse me, Lieutenant Winder. We got back, you know, we got back safe and sound. Don't you think we ought to land this thing?
Instead of trying to play tricks up there.
Yeah.
So did you put the mask on the way back?
No.
Oh, natural on that
it.
One, too.
Yeah.
Wow.
That one nice thing, impressive. Paul, when we got back, they gave us a chit. That entitled us two shots of bourbon. And it was almost like, thank you for the medicinal effect of the bourbon, you know.
You needed some after that.
It kind of a reward of the trip.
Did it give you, you said the purpose was for you to understand what these other guys were going through. Did it give you more of an appreciation for just how tough that in itself was and them getting over the hump and back?
I don't think so, Paul, because we looked at it as strictly radio work. You know, here he is sitting there and enjoying seemingly a sceneful ride, and that was about it. But I think the effects would have been if something went wrong with the ship mechanically, and then you see what the crew has to do, or if they had to fly through that monsoon weather, and then you realize.
Now, you didn't fly through a monsoon yourself, but you were on the ground, and this is something that I think people will really be moved by. And you hear today, I mean, we get so many things today with the way the media is now. We hear the 911 calls, and we hear the voice data recorders on airplanes that go down. Now, here you are at a radio station for the Army Air Corps during one of these monsoons, and you're getting mayday calls left and right from planes that basically aren't moving because the wind is so strong. Describe that for us, if you can. And what was that like to feel helpless and not be able to help these guys out at all?
Well, we only had one we called a DF, directional finder. And here they are yelling, mayday, mayday, mayday. And here it is. It could have been midnight, 1, 2 o'clock in the morning, and they're calling for help. And they're flying into these winds up to, egads, enough to where the ship was not progressing back into India. It was almost like they're hitting a stone wall. And we tell them, okay, give us a count. So they go 1, 2, 3, 4 in order to try and get a fix on them. And next thing, sorry, we got to bail out, you know, wish us luck or whatever. It's frustrating to hear all these maydays, and you have one directional finder to use, and it takes time to lock in.
So in theory, if you were able to locate them, you could dispatch someone else to go look for them, so when they do bail out, they can get picked up. Is that how you would respond?
Well, it depends upon where they, shall we say, landed in the jungle. We had search and air rescue. And you would have the proximate area where they bailed out, but then you have the winds, Paul. Who knows how far it carried the chutes? Who knows if the chutes opened, you know, in that particular type of weather? So it was just a bad time, just a bad time.
Really. Well, I can't imagine what that felt like. I know there were lighter moments for you, too. And when we get into the final segment of the show, I want to talk to you about some serious stuff that you dealt with at the tail end and even after the war and some of the things that you witnessed. But as far as life in the service during the war itself and in that part of the world in particular, I've talked to a lot of veterans who served in China or Burma or India, and they seem to have interacted a lot with wildlife that they wouldn't have gotten to interact with back in the States, certainly not in Los Angeles. I understand that some of your fellow servicemen like to monkey around in the showers sometimes, or at least that's what you thought was happening. Tell us about that.
I was taking a shower, and there was no one there, and suddenly something scratched the top of my head, and I thought, oh, boy, you know, here they are horsing around. I turn around, no one there. And I knew I got scratched on top of my head, and I thought, am I ended up being jungle happy? So I continued to soap myself. All of a sudden, I'm scratched on top of my head again. So I look up, and hanging from a broken thatched roof was this monkey grinning at me and scratching my head. And, Paul, my heart went in my throat, and if I looked around for something to throw at that monkey, and all I had was water and soap, you know. And some of the individuals had monkeys as pets.
Right, right.
In fact, one of them, on the way home, snuck one aboard ship, and unfortunately it died, and when it did, overboard. So another one came with an ocelot. It was like a kitten, and chewed up some of the, shall we say, wardrobe that we had. It was something. It was like a playful kitten.
Now, the other thing that I've heard from a lot of veterans who served in that theater of World War II, disease was a huge factor. Guys would get dysentery, all kinds of different, you know, beriberi, different diseases that, because of that part of the world, were more prevalent. anything like that run into where you were, and were you ever afflicted by anything along those lines?
When I was in Tezpur, I ran a fever. It would come and go, and at night, I couldn't get enough blankets. In fact, I got some of the so-called overcoats from some of the buddies there to try to keep warm, and it lasted roughly 24, 36 hours. I didn't want to go to the infirmary because they had a ruling. You have to bring your entire barracks bag because some of the individuals would go to the infirmary to avoid duty. And in Chabwa, I was taking a shower, and I, for whatever reasons, looked at my chest and my stomach, and it was like if somebody took a 5-cent piece and heated it up and just punched me all over the front of my body. And directly across the way was our infirmary, and I ran over there. They didn't know what it was, skin diseases. Said, well, we'll try this. Thanks for trying. You know? And dysentery was not uncommon. Fortunately, we had shots like cholera, yellow fever, typhus, et cetera, that the bad part about it, I don't know, after the shot, if you say the value of the shot wore off, if that disease would hit you when you came home, I have no idea. But
just things you had to learn to live with, I suppose.
Definitely, yeah.
And not complain about. Well, we're running short on time, but we still have one little piece of the program left. So we'll take our final commercial break, then talk more with World War II veteran Bob Angelich, our guest today. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ. In 3, 2, 1. Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. As usual, you're going to hear me say that we're running out of time. This always happens to me, but I'm sure that it's been well worth the time you spent listening today, if for no other reason than to hear the voice of my guest, Bob Angelich. I'm so jealous of his deep, resonant speaking voice that does work very well on radio. It worked in the U.S. Army Air Corps, and it's working on the program today. Bob, we've talked about your family and how involved your siblings and your cousins were during World War II. I'm going to try to track down a couple of your cousins to be on this program. Did you ever make a count of how many people in your extended family were serving in one area of the war or another? And I understand there was one point where you could have had three of them in, together in the same place, but they didn't even know it.
That was in Pearl Harbor. My younger brother was a submariner, and our other cousin was a individual in charge of parachutes, and that was on the Franklin. And fortunately, Sam, due to a condition, was not aboard when that thing got bombed. Cousin John was with the aerial photography over in London. Cousin Lee was on the USS Ricky, which was a hospital ship. And my other two cousins, we never discussed with their military. There was nine of us, plus the fact that we lost, as mentioned earlier, a cousin there at Pearl Harbor,
wow.
Jerry. Yeah.
Well, your extended family has certainly done a lot to secure the freedom for the rest of us that we're enjoying today by having this program on the radio. And I understand, before we get to some of what you did after the war and how that kind of ties in, you told me that the saddest day of the war for you was when you got on that ship in Karachi and were coming home. The war was over for you. For a lot of veterans, that's the happiest day they can remember. They're coming home. Why was that not the case for you?
Leaving the base there in Karachi to go aboard ship, as we're going out the gate, and I looked over to the left side, and here was a small cemetery with little American flags flying. And it brought to mind how we were so fortunate. We're going home, and here are these individuals buried there in Karachi. And it was a feeling, but for the grace of God, there I lie. And it's a moment that's going to stay, I think, with me the rest of my life.
I can see it in your eyes that it still is there. And I imagine every Memorial Day, every Veterans Day, it kind of comes back for you.
It is, Paul. Like they say, those of us who came back like we're heroes, but you hear so many veterans say, the heroes never came back.
Mm-hmm. I have heard a lot of them say that, and I know you feel that way as well. And if not for the guys who didn't come back, I think a lot of people also look to those who came back without a piece of themselves, those who came back missing a limb or missing a big emotional piece of who they were before the war. I know you've had a lot of experience with this. After the war, you actually got into the prosthetics field. So you spent a lot of time around men who had been injured during the war and were now dealing with loss of limb, and trying to help them cope with that and get them situated with prosthetics that would make them or help them function better in life. What was that like? And was that difficult to see these guys and realize how big of a price that they paid?
Paul, the beautiful thing about that, I spent 14 years in prosthetics and orthopedics. And in that time period, I only saw one veteran who was bitter, and he was above knee amputee. Other than that, all the rest of them had a real positive attitude. In fact, I even saw one who had absolutely no leg left at all, if I could put it that way. And he was following a tank over in Europe, and an 88 shell just took his leg off right at the hip. Mm. And yet he had a good attitude. I would say the rewards were helping them to be able to motivate where they had confidence, going up and down stairs, getting in and out of a car, being able to drive a car. The limb, whether it was below the knee, above the knee, was in a healthy state, no ulcers, the comfort. Those were the rewarding factors, especially when they look at it and say, thank you.
Oh, I bet. Yeah. And I bet that's another situation where you're thankful that you came back in one piece, and probably hard to complain about anything when you spend your day around someone who's missing a leg from his time in the service.
Well, it shows you, Paul, really, like the old saying, I complained about my shoes until I saw an individual with no feet. So when you saw these individuals and their attitude, et cetera, and you're back in your entirety as you left, you feel very fortunate. Blessed.
Did you hear a lot of their stories, too? Did you
guys
trade war stories?
Being a GI, I well remember this one, and he told me he'll never forget. They're in the battlefield, and he looked over, and he saw this individual, and his arm was being held between his feet, and he's crying. He's trying to get the ring off his hand. That's what stayed in his mind. He wanted that ring because it meant the closeness to his wife.
Now, I can hold my arm between my legs and try to get my wedding ring off, but that's not what you're describing. You're saying his severed arm.
I'm sorry. Right. He lost his arm.
So his arm is separated from his body. He's got his severed arm wedged between his legs trying to wrestle the wedding ring off.
Right. Wedged between his feet trying to get the wedding ring off.
Wow. You know. That's determination for you.
You know, Paul, it's amazing. We know what we want to say, and sometimes we don't say it properly.
So no, I knew what you were saying, and I just wanted everyone at home to realize that is something special and definitely underscores that determination and that devotion. Boy, I wish we had more time. We're running short on it. Is there anything you want to share from your experience with those people who lost limbs? And it wasn't all veterans that you dealt with, but people that lost limbs in one fashion or another, and helping them with their lives moving forward with prosthetics. And a lot of young men and women are in that position today, especially with the IEDs in Iraq. There are a lot of servicemen and women who are dealing with that. Was there one thing that you tried to share with them other than just providing them with this new piece of equipment? Or did you feel like they didn't really need any pick-me-up or any motivation?
I think, Paul, if they felt a compassion and one that did not show sympathy along that particular line, they were appreciative. I think they felt very fortunate to be back. That was one thing, regardless of what the condition happened to be, and that they were able to carry on what they felt was a normal life. And I have nothing but total admiration for these individuals who have that attitude.
I can tell, and I'm with you there. Well, Bob, I'm sorry that we're out of time, but thanks so much for being on the program, and I might have you back just to introduce all our guests because your voice is so much better than mine. Thanks for being with us today.
Paul, my pleasure, and thank you.
All right, that's Bob Angelist, our guest today. We'll be back next week with another edition of Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ. Wonderful.